most prominent Israeli religious singer, Chaim David, and he's going to be at Ohr HaRuach 7:30 Saturday evening. Tickets are $20, which is a mitzvah. We're almost invited.
We have been, for those who may not be able to attend in the first place, we have a group of people who want to come who it might be possible to find tickets on their behalf.
Nobody said that to me. And we do have, as a matter of fact, for this concert, one, the way that we're running it is that we have a number of supporters who have made contributions, and that's how we finance it. We do it that plus the tickets, we'll end up paying for it. So some of our congregants who have heard last time we were here at his last concert, we really felt that this was a worthwhile thing for us to do, who have contributed to make it happen again. So all we seek is to break even from these things. But I haven't been made aware of any people who want to come who can't come for financial reasons.
I think the one who is here
He's not from Mobile. Oh, wait, you saw him. He was at Hanalei's wedding, though. He was at Hanalei's wedding. From Mavon Modin.
I don't know. He came
That was different. Chaim David lives in the old city of Jerusalem. He's my friend from Jerusalem. He's a student of Shlomo Kaulbach. So it's that and sort of, I don't know how to describe it. He writes a lot of his own music. Uh-huh. He's written many of his own, much of his music is his own. And his own stuff is just, I think, amazing. It's very spiritual music. It's intensely spiritual music. And he takes verses from the Psalms, from the prayer book, and he creates his own melodies with essentially a rock band with a violinist. That's what he had last time. Last time he had a drummer, a violinist, he plays the guitar, and is there somebody else? Anybody remember? If I remember correctly, the violinist also played the clarinet. He was a clarinetist. It's very, very avant-garde type of music. It's a type of Israeli avant-garde music. We have some of this spiritual stuff. The whole piece of Israeli music, which I would call spiritual music. There's no counterpart in this culture to it. It's just its own thing. There are a number of people who are doing this. He's by far not the only one. Groups called Revel Sheva. Have you heard of them? Revolution. Guy lives right outside of Jerusalem. Chaim David lives right overlooking the Temple Mount in the old city. They're all amazing people, these people. They're very deeply spiritual people. Very powerful. Very humble but powerful people. Very interesting.
Born in Israel?
Born in South Africa. That's also very interesting. I mentioned it to some people. There is a very creative group of South African Jewish composers and instrumentalists and singers. And they're part of this group. I mean, they're touch with people like Chaim David. But in South Africa, these people mainly come. South Africa is a very, Johannesburg is a very strong Lubavitch community, as does Australia. So it has a tremendous, Chabad has had a tremendous impact there. So there are a lot of young people or not, and then not at all like what we know in Brooklyn. I mean, just a million miles away. They're not much. They're like us in many ways. These people are working on a fusion. They call it in music, fusion between Zulu music and Jewish music, because they feel that the Zulu culture has an indigenous spirituality to it, and that if these guys work with the Zulu musicians, that they will be able to each feed off the other in terms of the spirituality in their cultures. So that's what they're doing. And there's a whole piece of South African Jewish music which is essentially, and the Jews play in the nightclubs in Soweto. I talked to those guys. And that comes, you heard them. They were at our, it was one of these guys was at our house when you were there. You remember Renata Taylor? Remember that guy who was singing?
He's a musician.
He's a musician. The South African musician.
He's a
musician. Yeah. Also a Yeshiva Bacham. But he makes a living being a musician. That's how he makes a living. Strange. Interesting things going on in the world of music. Music is a universal language. That's the amazing thing about music. If you can attach to music, you just are in another world, which is a universal world. Okay, we're on 21B2, left side of the page, down toward the bottom. You remember what we are dealing with here. We are dealing with this psychology as background, but the halacha as foreground, about what one says when you go into the house of Shiva. And you remember, basically, you say nothing. You are not allowed to ask the mourner, Mashlomcha, how is your peace? The mourner has no peace. And we saw that in several different stages as we read it on the previous page, but it's also on 21b, Nishloshava ad Shiva Meshiv Ve'eno Shawel. Okay? From the third day, oh, let's go back even further than that. Tanu Rabbanan, Avel Shoshaya Nima Rishonim Asubi She'elat Shalom. A mourner during the first 3 days is prohibited to greet. Nishloshava ad Shiva Meshiv Ve'eno Shawel. From 3 to 7, he responds but doesn't ask. From the end of Shiva on, he can ask about someone's welfare and he can respond to them normally. Right? Then you will remember that we read a baraita that was different from that. That was the Rabbi Akiva story. Well, that was also a demurl. Nishlosha v'ad shiva meshiva eino shoel. Our Baraita said, from the third day until the seventh day, he can respond, but he can't ask. Mikan v'elo shoelo meshiv kadarko. From 7 days on, he can ask and respond normally. Or Amin, who the Baraita said, hamotzeh chavero avel betoch shloshim yom. If a person finds his friend is a mourner, betoch shloshim yom, during the 30-day mourning period, midaber imo tanchumim, he speaks with him words of comfort. Ve'eino shoel bishlomo, but you do not ask him how he is, right? Now this is the 30-day period. Li'achar shloshim yom, after 30 days, shoel bishlomo, ve'eino midaber imo tanchumim. He asks how he is, after 30 days, but he doesn't speak with him about words of mourning, words of comfort. In other words, here this baraita is saying that once the 30-day period is over, you don't bring up the death again. You don't bring it up, okay? You don't have to initiate some sort of words of comfort because it's really out of place after 30 days. Okay, and we read about the death of a wife and so on. then you remember we saw Rav Idi Bar Avin said, "Hu sho'el b'shlom acherim, sh'acherim shruim b'shalom." That a person should ask, is permitted to ask about others after the 3 days, because others are shruim b'shalom, they're okay. Acherim ein sho'alim b'shlomo sh'hu eino sh'arui b'shalom. But others shouldn't ask about his shalom because we know he's not at peace. Therefore, we don't want to put him into that uncomfortable position. We'll skip that because those were just clarifications. Okay? Now, down to the bottom of 21b2, left side. Let's read the English here. The last paraita that the Gemara quoted stated that once Shloshim had passed, one can greet a mourner in the ordinary way and should not offer him condolences. Right? That's what we read just a minute ago. Once the Shloshim is passed, you can greet him in an ordinary way and you don't give him words of tanchumim, of comfort. Right? Uraminu. Now comes, as we've seen this several times, the Amoraim come and they bring us an objection to some baraita that we've just studied, and it's with another baraita. If a person sees his friend who is a mourner within 12 months of the death, he greets him, he speaks words of comfort to him, and he does not ask him words of shalom, how he feels. Okay? 12 months. What did we just read? We just read 30 days. Right? We just read this kind of an arrangement for after the 30-day period of time. Now we're reading it 12 months. Now it's a shitso. That's an objection. That's an oraminu. Okay? Midaberi motan chumim ve'eno sholom ish. Li'achar shnei masar chodesh. After 12 months, Sho'el bishlomo, he asks his peace, the eno medaberi motan chumim. But he doesn't speak with him words of comfort. Interesting. Here it's telling us that after the 12-month period has passed, you don't bring up the subject of the death. And look at the comment that's made here. Aval nedaberi mo min atzad. But you can speak to him about the death coyly. Min atzad, from the side. Not directly, but indirectly. Indirectly. Alright? Amar Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Meir says, if a person finds his friend who had been a mourner after the 12-month period has passed, and you speak, you initiate with him directly words of comfort, lemahu domeh, what is this like? What is this person who initiates those words of comfort like? Li'adam shenishbara raglo. It's like a man who broke his leg. V'chayta, and he got better. His leg got repaired. U'mitza'o rofe, and a doctor finds him. V'amarlo, and says to him, Klach etzli, come to my office. Shani Shovra, because I'll break your leg again. Ani Er Ta'ena, but I'll fix it this time. Samamanim Sheli Yafin, and I'll do a much better job than the last guy did. Okay. What a funny. This is Rabbi Meir. This is what it's like when you raise the issue directly of the death after the 12 months have passed. Right?
So when you said after 12 months, the person is already at peace.
Okay, that is
certain.
Exactly. Now you can do it min atzad. Okay, you can do it from the side. You can do it indirectly. But to do it directly is in a way an assault on the level of healing that has taken place already. And it's interesting that, that this comment is made in terms of a year. We have not seen this comment made really otherwise. It's made in terms of a year. And generally we have found that a year is basically the time it takes to recover from a loss. A year is the minimal amount of time.
Well, what the unveiling is, what is the time period there? If the unveiling has already occurred before the end of the year,
mm-hmm.
then what is the relationship?
Well, that's one of the reasons that you want to have the unveiling before the end of the year. Because
so
you
from
want
the time of unveiling to the end of the year.
Not actually, because there is no real time for unveiling.
I know.
You have to remember that our custom of unveiling has no precedent in Jewish law at all. Simply a local custom that we have here in America. It has no precedent anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We are the only Jews who do this, as far as I know. The Israelis don't know what we do. They have no custom like what we have. Our custom is generally to do an unveiling around the time that you finish saying Kaddish, around 11 months. That's, as far as I know, uniquely an American custom. I don't think it's done anywhere else. So, and we say, there's a logic to it, because we say you complete Kaddish and it's before the end of the year, because you don't want to do it after the end of the year, because, again, you're opening up a wound. The thing is that certain things heal by themselves after a while, and you don't want to open up a wound, and there's basically nothing you can do. Basically, whatever healing has happened, like the man who broke a leg. Right? Whatever has happened, he's recovered himself. And it is what it is. It basically
is
what it is.
Is the time frame that rigid?
Is what?
Is the time frame that rigid that it has to be exactly a year? Or you use your imagination? Or you
Well, in most cases, look, if they told me 11 months, you'd ask the same question. If they told me 12, 13 months, you'd ask the same question.
No, I mean, you see that the motive of the person.
No. Most of the time, you don't know the motive of a person. Tell you the truth. Most of the time, it's much better to go by the law than to gauge the mood of a person. Because, someone you're intimately involved with, of course. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about where you see a person after a long hiatus. Okay? So, in that case, we're really. We need, or it's valuable, to have certain generally accepted ways of doing things. Will it be right all the time? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
As I said to you last time, were you here last week?
No.
Last week I said in the application of these laws, you must remember to use also sechel and derech eretz. Okay? Sechel and derech eretz. But that doesn't mean you don't have a law, you don't have a framework. I described this in terms of etiquette. Etiquette exists basically to give the community some sense of proper action, and etiquette generally has to do with the expectations of respect toward other people in a variety of social circumstances. Okay?
I was talking about an incident that happened to me. A neighbor of mine had lost a daughter over a year ago, and I asked her how she was, and she burst into tears. How should I feel? And
so that's a perfect example of what happened. Thank you very much. You proved the point.
I think the year is really very important, and I think it being exactly a year is also important because you have to go through the cycle of holidays because each holiday rekindles the expectations about the person who's no longer there being there, and therefore I think it takes a minimum of a year to work through those anticipations and creating a new environment in which that person isn't there for that holiday.
Good. Let's go a little bit further. I want to go further because you're going to see a clarification. Realize we've only read it in Uraminu here. Uraminu has said to us now that there is a rule that applies about a year. After a year, you go about things in a normal way. It was brought as an Araminu because we had learned just a moment before that was a 30-day time. then after 30 days you do it. So now we have a contradiction between two statements of two different tana'im brought without any attribution. One says that this is after a month. The other says that it's after a year. How could it be that these two things say, you know, they seem to contradict one another? Characteristically, the way the Gemara usually handles this, and as it handles it here, lo kasha. This is not a contradiction. This is not a problem. Right? You thought it was a problem. Ha biavivim, oh. The case we have just read about, where we are talking about a year, that applies to his father and his mother. Ha bisha arkovim. The other applies to other relatives. Now that is standard procedure as far as the laws of mourning go, that the laws of mourning for a parent are qualitatively, quantitatively different than they are for all of the other mourners. Right. Some of them it may be a little hard to understand, but basically the relation to the parent is considered to be the unique situation.
Parents to son is the same like son to
No. Parents to son is it's completely son different. Dies. Son dies 30 days. No. Now realize why this is. I mean, you could argue maybe it shouldn't be. But until probably 80 years ago, the death of children was a normal piece of living. You know, the reality with which we are living is, frankly, in historical proportions, it's just radically different. So I think, again, you have to use Sechel and Derech Eretz here. You have to basically judge the reality of the situation and judge it in ways that reflect the reality in which we're living, because there is a difference in our modern reality. Although at the same time, there is something about it, with a psychiatric issue, the relation of a child to a parent. It is a unique relationship. And even the relation of a parent to a child is not that. It's just different.
And commandments honor thy father and thy mother.
Correct. Correct. And it's partly a guilt issue, too. Last year we discussed the subject of guilt in relation to the laws of mourning. Remember that the laws of mourning, when we read my book, Rabbi Soloveitchik, said that essentially the laws of mourning are like the laws of Yom Kippur, because they are ways of self-mortification. They are forms of hurting the self, which is there to deal with the natural feelings of guilt that one has upon the death, particularly of a parent. And that's why psychiatrists make their living. No? And am I a psychiatrist here? No? Okay. Don't be to the offended then, yes.
But the same book, I think I remember from Dr. Lamb's book from many years ago that I thought it was an interesting point. He said that children need more of a reminder. You know, a spouse isn't, it's not going to stay on a day-to-day basis. The loss is there, but children have lives and they're moving on and they need more of a...
That's why Dari was saying, that's like a Torah. Honor your father and your mother. You have to tell the children they're supposed to act in a certain way. This is like that. Okay? Let's go a little bit further.
How old do you have to be to mourn?
Well, as in anything, as soon as you are able to do it, we want you to do it, and then you are not legally required until you become a bar or bat mitzvah. Okay? Okay, so the Gemara said, Lokashia, Habi Aviv, Abi Mo, Habi Sha'ar Krovim. We have two different states. One is for the parents, which is a 12-month period, and the other is for the other relatives, which is a 30-day period. That, by the way, applies also for Kaddish, though most people don't realize it, and, you know, we don't object if people do something in addition, usually. But strictly speaking, one says Kaddish for every relative except a parent for only 30 days. Only 30 days. And not for the 11 months. Okay. Okay, go on. Hatanan yidaberi motan chumim min atzam. But now there, when we were talking about the 30-day period, wouldn't it make sense also that he speak with his friend Minatsan from the sides, indirectly, okay? Even after the Shloshim is passed, because we saw that with the year period, after that is passed, the person who greets the mourner has to do it indirectly. So shouldn't it have said that also for the person after 30 days? And the Gemara, interestingly here, answers, Inachinami, you're right. You're right. That's correct. That's correct. Umay enu madaberi motanchumim. And what is the fourth then when we have in the Baraita where it says that you don't direct speak to a person words of comfort? Kedarko. You don't do it in a normal fashion. You know, it didn't tell us everything that it meant. It was in shorthand, that particular Baraita. Aval medaberi motanchumim. After the 30-day period has passed, likewise, if you do speak to somebody, and you shouldn't speak directly, but you can speak indirectly about the death. Okay? Now, I wanted to read to you the section in Maurice Lamb's book, The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. I've said to you that I think that this is the most useful of all of the secondary literature that we have, and it's a book that all of you should own. Every Jewish home should have this book. It's available in any Jewish bookstore. It's, most of the time you buy it in paperback, whatever. This is his section on greetings and gifts. With the shocking disruption of normal life caused by a death in the family, the standard forms of social intercourse, its niceties and graces and minutiae of etiquette, are without significance. The mourning heart has no patience for these formalities. Tradition thus scorns all types of greeting during Shiva. The sages, who consistently demand that one greet all people graciously and courteously, regard greetings as out of place when spoken by or to the mourner. It is absurd to say to a man deep in anguish over someone he loved, "Hello, how are you feeling today?" This is not only a question that cannot be answered, it indicates a lack of compassion and understanding. The Shalom Alechems and the Hellos are hollow and purposeless, even offensive to the despairing heart. Certainly, as Maimonides, the 12th century sage, taught, we must strongly discourage the misplaced small talk and lightheartedness of some mindless visitors. Now, in terms of what we were talking about last week in terms of the American Shiva House, this is more or less de rigueur. I mean, mindless visitors, in the Maimonides terms, is the way we live. That's what we consider to be appropriate behavior. Okay? The rejection of greetings at this time, far from betraying a lack of cordiality, issues from a profound insight into man's nature and a deep compassion for his predicament. This law, as so many other laws of bereavement, originated with Ezekiel. God tells Ezekiel, remember the phrase we read last year, He anek dom, sigh in silence. Sigh in silence. Indeed, how can one mourn more eloquently than by sighing in silence? The sages offer a second reason for avoiding the standard greeting of Shalom. Shalom is one of the names of God, and greeting in the name of God at a time when God has taken a close relative could conceivably be, in the spirit of the mourner, an intimation of scoffing and an invitation to question God's justice at a time when he is required to proclaim God's justice as in the Tzidduk Adin prayer, or as in the Kaddish. What the mourner is required to do is, in fact, to be put into position of saying God is just, you know, at the very moment when the mourner has every reason to assume that God is not just. So we have this sort of behavioral therapy, which is counterintuitive. Traditionally, therefore, Jews do not extend greetings to the mourner. The visitor enters the door, usually left slightly ajar to avoid the first meeting and greeting, and sits down without fuss and bother to share the grief of his neighbor. And he goes through a series of points. One, during Shiva, the mourner should not extend greetings to others natural and others, sorry, Israel, and others naturally should not bid him shalom. Right? That's what we've read. Two, when greetings are extended by visitors out of ignorance, the mourner during the first 3 days may not respond to a greeting. He should indicate graciously that he is a mourner and is not permitted to do so. That's what we read last week. After the 3 days, he may respond to the greeting out of courtesy, but should do so in an undertone to indicate respect to both the person and the tradition. An interesting little touch that he adds to it as a result of later halacha. Three, after Shiva, he may initiate the greeting and may respond to it. Okay, so after Shiva, he may initiate a greeting and respond to it.
As opposed to Shloshim.
Customarily, however, the mourner is not greeted with shalom for the full year of mourning in the case of a parent's death and for the 30 days after the death of other relatives. That's what we just read. Okay? So, he may initiate the greeting. Remember, we learned that last time. Why can he initiate a greeting to others? Because they're not mourning. They have shalom. They have shalom. So the problem is not from him to the others. The problem is from the others to him. Because you don't want to put the others in an awkward position once they find out that he doesn't have shalom. Okay? And it may also be offensive to him. So customarily, the mourner is not greeted with shalom for a full year of mourning in the case of a parent's death, 30 days after the death of other relatives. Four, if a large contingent of people visits as a group, such as, for example, representatives of an organization, he may bid them farewell. Where does that come from? There's a story of Rabbi Akiva that we read last week. Remember, Rabbi Akiva had lost his two sons, and the people came, and Rabbi Akiva responded, and he said goodbye to them. And the Gemara was wondering, why could he say goodbye? Because the tzibur is different. When you are responding to the public, in fact, it's different. And here you see that the practical result of that is, in fact, any such public. So that if a group comes as a public, not as individuals, but they come to pay a call as a public, then, in fact, it's appropriate for you to greet them as a public. And that actually changes things. On the five, on the Sabbath, the mourner may wish others Shabbat Shalom and they may respond. That's an interesting one. That on the Sabbath, things are different. I had to explain this just the other day to one of our families that was mourning, that when the Shabbat comes, it's appropriate to the family to sit around the table, to sing Shalom Aleichem, to sing Zmirot, Birkat HaMazon, all those things because the Sabbath takes precedence. As to whether others may initiate greetings, there is conflicting opinion, and the mourner should follow the practice of his own community. It's an interesting problem. It's not a simple problem. There's no easy answer to it. We have this problem regularly in the synagogue. Somebody comes to the Shabbat service, and many people who haven't paid a Shiva call see the person who has come to the Shabbat service. So, you feel like you have to say something, you know, and you want to greet them in a way because it just seems like you should be doing that, you know. So it's an area that, on the one hand, we all know you don't want to treat them as if it's just another Shabbat, because it isn't just another Shabbat. You don't want to treat them the way we would have said before, even if it could be in the first 3 days. Where you wouldn't greet a person at all. So, essentially, you just... People, frankly, handle it very well. I mean, when people come into the public community, people have the expectation, even before that happens, that people will come over, and then people people know how to handle it. I always feel it happens the right way. I can't even think of an exception.
You have to find the minor key.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's natural for most people, most people in our environment anyway, in this piece of our culture, I mean, this piece goes up to about 96th Street, down to 57th Street, you know, maybe river to river probably, to include your West Siders. But it's, people know what to do. It's been my experience. Let me just go a little further. Six, may visitors greet each other in the house of mourning? That's an interesting problem. Mm. You are a Gantra Shiva house, and other people come in who you know. What should be your conduct toward them? It is considered in poor taste even to utilize the word shalom in the house of mourning, especially since one must then differentiate between the greeting spoken to the bereaved and that spoken to the comforter. Seven, other forms of greeting to the mourner, not using the word shalom, such as good evening, etc., should also be avoided. Merely sitting beside the mourner is sufficient. If one desires to approach the mourner directly, the mention of his name alone is indicative of both courtesy and the compassion of his bereavement. Visitors may greet each other without utilizing the word shalom. And I think that what actually happens here, we have a case in a place like Rosh Hashanah, for example, where mourners will frequently come to the minyan in the morning during Shiva. For whatever reason, they don't have a minyan at home, and so they'll come during the morning, the week of Shiva, and be with us in the minyan. Truth is, you shouldn't say, "How are you?" in that context. But what I think works is Boker Tov, or good morning. Boker Tov, good morning. It's nice to see you. Or say hello. That's not to say. You say hello.
No. You know,
you have to be sensitive.
This is my problem with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the worst things that you can do is to embarrass or insult a person and make them feel uncomfortable.
Of course, so you don't do it. You should never do that.
If I'm mourning and somebody comes in and doesn't know,
then you do.
Then
it.
I have.
You weren't here last week. Mm-hmm. Last week. You weren't here last week.
No.
Last week we dealt with that. You have to respond to them courteously. That's the proper way to do it.
And not make them feel.
Of course. Of course. But this is not meant to make people feel bad. It is meant to take cognizance of feelings and then to create a social etiquette out of it. And of course, particularly where everyone is not on the same page, which is the case for most of us. In our society, you cannot assume that everybody knows, or that everybody accepts, or that everybody has the same level of practice. You can't assume any of those things. That's why you have to use sechel and derech eretz.
But also their appearance, okay. That they have rent clothes, or if they haven't shaven, then they usually shave them. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in that kind.
That's also true. Or even in our community.
Sackcloth and ashes, you know. So.
No, but there are very common, very demonstrable ways that mourners show that they're mourning. And in fact, you know, along the lines of what you're saying, even as far as a person's level of tradition, their comfort level with a tradition goes, that's sometimes obvious on that level as well. For example, if you see someone in our minyan with a ribbon on, it's one. If you see someone with a jacket torn, those are two very different people in terms of their place in the continuum of tradition. Mm-hmm. Because if a person has torn their jacket or their tie, you know that they're more just, they're concerned about doing things in a more traditional fashion. Okay? They're making a statement to you which you don't have to even ask them about. You immediately understand that, because we know those social cues, okay? So there are even indications like that, which give you a little bit of help, but you use this all in order to act intelligently. To say a few words about what he says beyond here, because I'm not sure that the Gemara actually deals with this. The proper way to bid farewell is to use the Hebrew phrase, Hamakom Yenachemechem, May the one who is in all places bring comfort to you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. that's the way you should properly say goodbye in the House of Learning. And we're actually going to develop this in the Chevra Kedisha during this year, because we found that people want to, many people want to do that, but they don't know how to do it. And we're going to have a session in December where we're going to just go over this again, and then we're going to try to create some cards or a card to place in the House of Mourning so that people will learn, or those people who are learning will be able to use these things as aids, and maybe we can, you know, have that more commonly done within our community. But again, it's hard to know how to say goodbye. It's hard to know how to say goodbye. But it actually helps to have a formula to say goodbye. And that's in many systems of etiquette. Hellos and goodbyes are done formulaically. And there's a tremendous value to the formulaic goodbye. Of course, this one also has a certain meaning to it, you know, it's an invocation of God's presence to act as a comforting presence.
How ancient? Do you always use the plural form even?
It's not clear. He says no. He says you use the singular, Hamakom Yenachem Otcha Otach. May God bring comfort to you, singular, male or female, depending upon who you're dealing with. Plural, etchem, if it's more than one person. That's not universal exception. Rabbi Luchstein, for example, I remember being at a shiva with Rabbi Luchstein once. Rabbi Luchstein was one morning there. Rabbi Luchstein says, Hamakom Yenachem Etchem Betoch Shaar Eretz Yerushalayim. And Rabbi Luchstein made a drasha. He says, we always say the plural. We never say the singular. Because the plural includes God. That God shares the peace of all of our mourning. When we mourn, God mourns with us. And therefore, we always use the plural. Excuse me? So, I mean, it's an interesting point of view, but that's a different halachic perspective. I follow that. I think that one should be uniform in doing that. It also gets, it's a little bit too complicated, because you don't always know how many mourners there are. You don't always know who the mourners are. You know if they're mourners. So I think just, again, I think that formulae are useful. And sometimes if you have the most useful formula, you stick to it. No, he goes on, he said right here, he says, one may use the translation as well. May God comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. That's what he suggests.
Indeed, no problem with the plural.
Indeed, there's no plural in English, right? Indeed, it is, after all, God alone who can provide the only valid lasting comfort at this moment of anguish. God in this phrase is referred to as Hamakom, which ordinarily means the place. It implies that the omnipresent God, who is every place at every time, present at birth and is now present in the house of mourning, knows the grief that is suffered by the mourners. He is the God who will grant you comfort. Okay?
How ancient is this phrase?
I don't know. I do not know where it stems from. So I said, as far as I know, it's not in the Talmud. I don't know how far back it goes.
So,
and I want to go just a little further. There's no reason why the visitors should not wish the mourner well. Another thing that might occur to you, that he be blessed with good health and strength. See, that's different. That in the long future he be shielded from great sorrow. People will frequently say that. It's a standard phrase I know in New York at least. May you not suffer sorrows for a very long time, or something like that. You often hear people say that. Or other appropriate blessings. Yes, that's what you say in Hebrew. It probably comes from something in Yiddish. I assume there was a Yiddish phrase that, because it's a very circumscribed group of Jews that says that, and it's said in English as well, so, and it's said in Hebrew. I assume there was probably a Yiddish phrase that it all comes.
Most Israelis, when they leave the home of the mourner, they would say Shiloti Dutzah, rather than to say Amakom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so
and
more.
Orthodox people would say Amakom Yenachem Otchem.
Right. Even more reason to assume it came from Yiddish. It must have been a folk saying. in the community. By the same token, the mourner may extend these good wishes or even mazel tov for some happy occasion to those who visit. It is psychologically and spiritually valuable for the mourner to demonstrate concern for others, for their sorry plight or their good fortune, although he himself is steeped in the despair of his own difficulties. So in fact, a mourner, say, someone had a baby, and the mourner is in the position that the mourner wants to, can say mazel tov. Right? That's permissible to do because it's honest, it's felt, and it's appropriate.
If his wife has a baby.
His wife has a baby.
She'll
say mazel tov?
Yes. Oh, you can.
Sure.
If she's mourning.
Because, as we said before, you can do those things that are natural. To bring gifts and material things to the mourner is not only in poor taste, but in violation of the traditional custom. The avoidance of sending gifts, now this is hard, most people don't understand this. Avoidance, because Christians do the opposite. That's why in our society, there's a knee-jerk reaction which is very different. We assume that you should send gifts to the mourner. To bring gifts and material things to the mourner is not only in poor taste, but in violation of the traditional custom. The avoidance of sending gifts is in the nature of avoiding greetings. It expresses only the superficial joys of friendship at a time of profound personal disorientation. Traditionally, the meal of condolence was the proper gift of consolation. Right? When the mourners come back from the cemetery, those who are concern for them should serve them a meal, should buy the meal, should set up the meal, should have the meal out. While obviously all visitors cannot provide this present, a gift to a charity in honor of the deceased is instead correct procedure. So he's advocating now charitable gifts in memory of the deceased, as opposed to physical things brought to the house of the Lord.
Isn't fruit often given?
Oh, often? Yes, but it's not appropriate. Yes, it is often given. It's an American custom. American has nothing to do with Judaism.
That's what I wanted to go back to. We have a custom of the unveiling, and this is a sense of closure, I would think, for the people that are mourning.
Yep.
And they have chosen at the unveiling to stop the mourning process. What we have there is the mourner has to comply to a certain period of time and has that responsibility according to this. So my question is how would this read if an unveiling were acknowledged, or how does this apply to the tradition that I'm more familiar with?
You're focusing just on an unveiling.
Well, I'm focusing on the interpretation and the application of law to my Jewish life or Jews, many Jews that I know. I mean,
it's a little hard to. It's too much in that question because I'm not sure what point.
I think Torah should apply.
But it's got to be very. These are very specific laws. They're very specific situations.
If a person has an unveiling.
Should you say anything to them? We're dealing with
after the unveiling.
Yeah.
Then I would think, and this is my understanding, that the unveiling is that the mourners, and that's organized by the mourning person, is saying that the mourning process for him or her is ended. Therefore,
well, that would not be according to the law.
No, the law is because
you can have an unveiling anytime you want.
That's right.
So, and that's not the law. Presupposes a period of 30 days for the relatives, a year for the parent, and that essentially has nothing to do with individuals. Law in general has nothing to do with individuals, except that one ought to be, of course, sensitive to individuals and their lives. The law basically creates a set of standards, which is a set of standards that is designed for the community.
Well, in your reading from Lamb, there was a point in there that the greetings and the handling of the mourning is consistent with the practices of the community.
Correct. Because in so many of these areas, many of the areas are subject to custom, but not all. General law, there's a difference between law and custom. And much of this is structured, quite structured by law. Other areas, it depends, we have to be specific what is subject to custom.
So, would it be correct to go to pay a condolence call, just walk in, sit down, say nothing, stay a while, leave and say nothing, and it would be within the context
correct.
Of
correct.
The safe way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You won't do anything wrong. Is there any rules for the condolers? How do you pay a condolence?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have a session here in December. The Heber Kaddish is going to run a session exactly on that. We're going to have a monk, we're going to ask some of our congregants who have just been mourners to sort of share their reactions to these things too, so we know really what it is. But the general rule is what he said, I think I read it before, that you come in, you sit down. He didn't mention just here, it is appropriate to talk about the deceased. You ideally wait for the mourner to speak first. If the circumstances are such where it just seems appropriate for you to say something, to the extent that you can, you initiate conversation about the deceased. That's the appropriate type of conversation. Okay? Which is opposed to... you don't talk about the Mets, the Yankees, and maybe they're desperate. Could be, in which case it might be appropriate. But I mean, it's the point that he made is, and again, it's our type of social intercourse tends to be strong on the small talk. Tends to be strong in the small talk.
How long do you stay?
Not too long. I'd say an ideal shiva call is usually about 20 minutes. I'd say about 20 minutes. That's a good point, Mark. People, again, that's a problem with leaving. I said before, one of the most difficult things is leaving. Knowing what to say, knowing when to get up, and it's a common source of discomfort for people. That people just, they don't want to do it too soon, they don't want to do it too long. And just to see the right balance. My experience has been about 20 minutes is about right, I would say.
But it comes to the service, and it's always uncomfortable if the whole crowd leaves right after.
But that's an interesting thing. When you come for the service, some people will do that, particularly if they really hardly know the mourner. It's a comfortable way of being there and of showing that you care in a situation where actually if you were much more personal, it would be uncomfortable. Because you really don't know the people. And you're sort of wondering why you're there. You're there because somebody told you it's really a good thing to do these things and it means something. So it's often a very nice thing to do and to go at the time of the service. And then a lot of people will come in and a lot of people will go out. Some people will come in a little early. Other people will leave a little late. But they'll sort of time their visit around that. And that also helps people in structuring these things, I found.
I generally pay a shiva call at the end, almost at the end of the shiva.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go in the beginning, generally speaking, most of them are very upset and there's a lot of tears. And I feel very uncomfortable going in at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I wait till the end of shiva when they've already kind of calmed down.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little bit calmer.
Mm-hmm. That's a very nice point because the truth is that you know yourself and you know where your comfort level is and you've seen enough of this to have a sense of when it's right for you and when you can, you know, in your own way express your, exactly, you can express condolences in a way that, that is comfortable for you, and that it will thereby be most comforting for them. So that's, you know, something that people sometimes decide for themselves.
Well, it's not mentioned in this section, but Baruch Dayan Emet, what is the source for this?
Baruch Dayan Emet is in the Talmud. In the Talmud, the phrase Baruch Dayan Emet is in the Talmud.
When you hear somebody in religious state,
we did that a couple of years ago.
Yep. The Baruch, that was the Masechet Brachot, in the ninth chapter of Brachot, where the Mishnah says, Kishem Shemavachim Ala Tova Gam Nevarchim Ala Ra'ah. Just as you say a blessing for good things, you have to say a blessing for bad things. What's the blessing? The blessing for good things is Baruch HaTov HaMeiti. The blessing for bad things is Baruch Dayan Emet. So that's in the Talmud. And when you say it, there are essentially two circumstances with you, when you say it. One is when you hear bad news. Okay? So let's say somebody calls you up and informs you of a death. Actually, the proper way to say the blessing is something that most people don't do correctly. Most people will say Baruch Dayan Emet. It's not correct.
No.
You should say Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Dayan Emet.
The whole thing. I always heard the whole thing.
Correct. Most people are incorrect.
Send an email.
You can't send an email. It's not the same thing. Email is not a bracha. It's a bracha levatla. It's a blessing, like any other blessing, and a full blessing should include shem umalchut. So it should Baruch Ata Hashem Eloheinu Melech HaOlam is Malchut. Okay, so that should be the full statement, and it's a long statement of response. Other time that is said is you'll say it at the time of making Kriya. That's our custom. Is you say when you make a tear, okay? We also see the Baruch Dayan Emet at that time.
The recollection in the Talmud, it had said Baruch Dayan Emet, and we were speculating on whether or not they meant Baruch Dayan Emet.
Correct. That's correct. We did talk about that. I told you that it was a professor from Brandeis who was here a few years ago. Kimmelman. Kimmelman contends that Talmud didn't mean to add but the halachic authorities disagree with him. I'm telling you about halachic authorities. Okay, that's what he said.
But it's grammatically correct.
I'm surprised that the meal, the
because it's a Christian custom. It's the Christianization of Jews. Jews have taken over that custom, and I don't know that it's a bad custom. The Christianization of Hanukkah. I'm the one who usually argues for the value of the Christianization of Hanukkah. And nowhere in Jewish history did anyone ever give a present for Hanukkah. Except in America.
Only used to give in Mahot.
Gelt. No such thing as presents.
Correct.
Right? No such thing. Never ever happened in the entire history of the Jewish people till about 80 years ago. In America. And only in America. No place else in the whole world.
They used to buy for children like new clothes or new shoes for Hanukkah because it's Hanukkah. Everything is Hanukkah. The diet Hanukkah.
Anyway, you ask any child, that's not what Hanukkah is about. It's not about no pair of shoes, no pair of pants. So the community, for example, I don't see anything wrong with people in taking care of food, but one should know that the mitzvah, that is no mitzvah, has nothing to do with Judaism. It's not a bad idea. A lot of things are a good idea and nothing to do with Judaism. Not one who says that only, you know, only Judaism has nice things to say. So it's not a bad idea, but it has nothing to do with Judaism. The Jewish requirement is to provide for the meal when people come back from the cemetery.
Is it that the moment of cooking children?
Excuse me?
I thought you cannot cook.
That's correct. Well, but most people don't have to cook for themselves. You don't. That's not entirely true. It is permissible to cook. If it's permissible, if you have no one to cook for you, you don't cook for yourself.
Okay. If you have friends who are
there.
Sometimes you pay the shiva calls, not within the Yorkville community, but the larger world out there. And you go in, and everybody is sitting around a table with an enormous amount of food on it, having all kinds of general conversation. To go into that kind of shiva and to sit down and not say anything, that in itself is it? What's the problem?
I think if you go in, I go into those situations every once in a while, and you know what you do? You sit down and you talk to the people. Because if you don't do that, it's impolite.
Yeah, everybody's what is wrong with the person.
So you have to yusechel. And I think that you go into that and you bring comfort to the people. Because in that context, you're right. It would be off the walls to suddenly start things. It's an interesting thing as far as mourning goes. One of the weird things about mourning is that every once in a while you find that people who are not observant become hyper-observant about mourning practices. Rabbis frequently encounter that. People don't observe the Sabbath, they don't observe kashrut, and yet when it comes to mourning, and you see that mourning, none of these laws come from the Torah. These are all laws of the rabbis. Compare it to a law like kashrut, for example, which comes from the Torah. It's God's word, you know. There's no comparison as far as the law goes. Or the observance of Sukkot, you know, the last days of Shemini Atzeret. Shemini Atzeret on a Tuesday. Shemini Atzeret on a Tuesday, God's law. It's a law to Moses on Mount Sinai, all right? The world will exist or not exist according to that, all right? But the law of mourning, nothing to do with the Torah at all. Nothing. But people will get extremely frum about mourning. So you see that also. I mean, it's not just that people do it in a Jewish style or an American style, whatever it is. But you also see the opposite. And you need a lot of sechel and derech eretz.
A little like Yom Kippur, people feel guilty.
Yeah, well, far be it for me to judge. I don't usually like to judge. And when we say that, we usually mean it pejoratively. You know, and people who suddenly get thrown about those things must feel guilty. Maybe yes, maybe it's, you know, the positive side of it is sometimes when you're confronted with death, people actually have an insight into religion which they've never had before. Suddenly, people will tell this to me very frequently, after they've said Kaddish, they just understand things about Judaism, about religion, which they never, ever were able to understand before. Every synagogue has people who really discover themselves as Jews as a result of mourning.
Because religion fills a need that they suddenly feel.
Whatever it is. That, again, I think, is to say that there's something wrong with it. But maybe it's a really... there are things that you learn when you go through these experiences that are deep, they're profound things. And that's the place where religion should begin.
Just clarify the rule now one more time. You can, during the first week of show, you can express your condolences, but you don't express any greeting. Is that correct?
Read it again.
Because I mean, here, you can go and say, I'm sorry for your loss.
There's a very good summary here at the bottom of 21b2. Look at the footnote number 18.
To summarize it.
Okay? Mm-hmm. During the first 3 days of Shiva, a mourner should not greet others, nor should he respond in kind if they unwittingly greet him. Rather, he should inform them that he is in mourning and cannot greet them. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's three. After the first 3 days until the end of Shiva, he should not initiate a greeting to others. Okay? He, the mourner, should not greet others, but he may respond in kind if they unwittingly greet him. Okay? After Shiva, he may greet others. Other people, however, should not greet him until after Shlosha.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, they should offer him words of condolence. In the case of someone who lost a parent, this applies until 12 months.
So you can say, I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. That's a common way that people will do it. It's a nice language that people will commonly use. I'm sorry for your loss. And that's one of the things that people say. Yeah? People, I'm not saying...
But why isn't that more emotional than... hello, good to see you today. I mean, that the greeting seems less emotional. I don't know. I mean, I guess if you say, how are you doing, that's not an easy greeting.
Again, it depends on what it is. Here. Okay? We're dealing with stages.
Mm-hmm.
And all you're saying is that it should be appropriate for the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we have these... not entirely arbitrary, but somewhat arbitrary stages of 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, and a year.
Because
mm-hmm. that's the whole structure of mourning. It goes like that. 3, 7, 30, and 12.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where the whole thing is structured.
I just wanted to pick up on what Francis said about going to Shiva call late in Shiva. And I think aside from whatever comfort level it means to the visitor, it seems to me that, you know, often the crowd thins out precipitously after the first few days, and I think in some ways it can be a greater comfort to the mourner, because the mourner gets to a point like, who pulls the plug? You know, all of a sudden there's nobody around.
Good point. It's also true.
And,
yeah.
You know, which makes me wonder also, is it inappropriate to go more than once during the week?
No. People will frequently do that when they have close friends. Because sometimes there are things you can do to be helpful too. There are many practical things that sometimes need to get done, and close friends can be helpful in that way. Okay? Good. Okay. On to the next subject. 21b3. Raises an interesting... not extremely common, but also not extremely rare situation. Tanu Rabbanan is an introduction to a Baraita again. Okay? We have a new subject. We've been dealing with Baraitot as Uraminhus. Uraminhus is the following objection was brought, so that's always in response to a previous Baraita. Now we're initiating a new subject, so it's Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis have taught. Avel Shlosha Yamim Arishonim. A mourner during the first 3 days. Okay, now let's read the English here because he fills in what Rashi fills in. Regarding a mourner, i.e., an immediate relative of the deceased, who was unaware of the death and arrived at the scene after the other relatives had already begun observing Shiva. Okay? Here's the theoretical case now. Somebody dies. The family begins to mourn. And there's one member of the family who comes late. Right?
They didn't notify.
Right? They weren't noticed. Okay? So already been unobserved and arrived at the scene after the other relatives. Now, the extent of being unaware... there are those who argue, as I'm sure your senses here, you know, what if just they couldn't make it? Okay, let's say somebody was on a holiday. No, that's it. That's why the comment unaware is not accepted by all the commentators, because there's another way, because that's not in the text, that's in the commentary. Okay? So it could be that they are unaware, it could be that they are not unaware, but that they were simply unable to make it back in time. Okay? This happens. I'm sure you can all think of circumstances where this happened. And they then come to the Shiva. The question is, how much of the Shiva do they have to observe? You get to Shiva late. You get to Shiva on the second day of Shiva. Do you have to observe 7 days? Or is the fact that you're joining an ongoing Shiva mean that when the Shiva for the rest of them is over, it's over for you too? That's the question that we're asking here. It's an interesting problem.
You can't sit Shiva while you're traveling, I guess, right?
You could.
So
you could.
If that was true, then they could start, if they knew.
In which case, that's why the unaware, the something the commentator said, it has to be unaware.
Right.
Okay? If he arrived within the first 3 days of Shiva, right? Avel Shlosha Yamim. If he arrives then in the house of Shiva during day one, day two, or day three, Bami Makom Karov Mone Mahem. If he comes from a nearby place, he counts Shiva together with them. Okay? Look at the note. If on the day when burial took place, when the rest of the family began to observe Shiva, he was within a day's travel from there, so that he might have arrived in time to begin Shiva together with the rest of the family. So if it was a theoretical possibility that he could have been with them, namely, that's dependent upon how far away he was, because in our context there would be more mitigating circumstances, because you can get a lot farther a lot quicker in the modern reality. Right? Then he can count Shiva with them even though he did not actually arrive and begin observing Shiva until a day or two later. Okay? That's if he comes from Makom Karov, a near place. Bami Makom Rachok. But if he comes from a place where he could not have made it, could not have begun it with them. Mone li'atzmo, he has his own counting. Right? He counts 7 on his own. Okay?
I would have guessed that it's really 7 days from the burial.
Not so simple. Well, hold off with that, because you're going to see that's going to come up very shortly. Okay, let's go a little further. Mikan ve'elach afilu bami makom karov. After the first 3 days, even if he comes from Makom Karov, a near place, a place that he could in theory have made it, had he known about it. Makom Karov, Mone Li'atzmo, he counts to himself. Okay, so it's only, we have a little window of the first 3 days. If you come within those 3 days, then you can be counted together with the others. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Afilu baba yom ha-shvi'i. Even if he comes on the last day, mimakom karov, from a near place, monei mahem. He counts with them. So, in theory, the last day, as you know, the last day is 1 hour. So this guy shows up 5 minutes before the end of Shiva, it's over. Alright, he doesn't have to sit any more than those 5 minutes of Shiva. Okay?
He doesn't have to sit
Shiva
with them at all.
Well, yeah, he's sitting 5 minutes of Shiva. Right? In theory, he could sit the absolute minimal amount, in theory. Okay? That's the opinion now of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon. Now, of course, Rabbi Shimon is disagreeing with the prior position, which lays down that you have to come within the 3-day period. He said, it doesn't matter when you come, as long as you come during Shiva. Okay? It's a different perspective. Now, keep in mind another circumstance here, which the law as it develops will be dealing with. And that is the circumstance of where somebody, where members of a family actually begin Shiva at different times. And they know what's happening, but they still begin at different times. Such as, when does Shiva normally begin? Very good. So let's say, and this happens here in New York. Somebody dies in New York. The family sits Shiva, but they want the person to be buried in Israel. One member of the family accompanies the body to Israel. They have the burial then, and then they come back to New York. Okay, to be with the family here in New York. When do you start Shiva? When do you start Shiva? The law is that the family that's in New York, when they leave whatever the event is, let's say the funeral, they start Shiva then.
Even though there was no burial.
Even though there was no burial, they start Shiva.
What if there's no event at any time?
When then, as soon as they leave the casket. Or as soon as the casket leaves. You'll see the way the Gemara will have language for it. It says the language is as soon as they turn back from the gates of the city. So that means basically as soon as they leave the casket. You know what I'm saying? As soon as they leave the casket, they begin Shiva. It could, in theory, particularly in pre-modern times, it could have taken a long time to do this. It could have taken a month. It could take a tremendous amount of time. Now you do it generally within a few days. But even, you know, the shortest amount of time is probably 3 days. Probably around, I mean, I've unfortunately gone back and forth to Israel. But I did it once in 3 days. I don't recommend it to anybody. You should never do that. It's a very bad idea, particularly if you're over 50. I think if you're around 20, maybe you can do it.
You need to take more melatonin.
You have to do what?
Melatonin?
Don't try it. Listen to me. Learn from my experience. But, so there's a lag period. So the question is then, if you come back, after having taken the body, do you sit Shiva on your own schedule or do you sit Shiva on the schedule of the people who started before? Okay? That's where we're going here. Because these are all real things that happen. Actually practical things that happen.
I think the thread that I see, and probably you'll find many indications of where I'm wrong, but it seems like in Shiva begins when the most traumatic event occurs in terms of the mourner's involvement in the process. So obviously if there is a burial, the minute the body is laid to rest, that's a very profound moment. If there's going to be a big delay, like the body is going off to Israel, then that event or the event from which you need to feel comforted begins at the time where the most traumatic thing occurs, which, as you say, would be leaving the funeral home. And so similarly, the people who come late, in terms of when they're identified and whether they sit Shiva or not, seems like the tilt toward the fact that they arrive and they hear about it. So now they're facing the trauma for the first time. So with the one exception of the 3 days, which I guess is because of the communal relationship, they're essentially entitled to have 7 days in which to work through their grief.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that holds up further on.
I don't know either. It's not a bad idea. Keep in mind that the way you you phrased it in terms of what was the most difficult, most tragic, traumatic. Traumatic. One could look at the process somewhat differently. As the Shiva begins, the same phrase you used before, is a closure. In fact, you close the ground, and there's a certain sense of closure that takes place psychologically at that point, which can't happen until you've done it. Can't really happen until you've done it. Though, however, one can imagine where, in fact, there's no way you're going to see that. Because you've sent somebody on a plane, you know, they've gone on the plane to Israel, and so in a way you're forcing them, if they can't sit Shiva, you're saying to them, you can't even act as if you have closure, when in fact maybe they should. So I'm substituting for trauma closure.
So what happened with 9/11, Jewish 9/11 victims? What were the halakhic?
That turned out to be pretty easy. At first, we weren't sure what was going to happen, but then the evidence was just so overwhelming that there was a presumption that if somebody, in a variety of circumstances, there was a presumption that people were dead. Because, you know, we had that, you remember what happened after 9/11? I remember in Oz Arua, the first thing that people wanted to do was to donate blood. People went to all the hospitals to donate blood. Nobody came for the blood. Nobody came for the blood. So there was a process there, and the halachic reactions were pretty much along that same process. When it became apparent that, in effect, everybody who survived, we knew that they survived, and those who didn't survive, we knew that they didn't survive, it was a little hard to assimilate that. But by the time we did assimilate it, in fact, at that point, the laws of Shiva kicked in.
So most people started doing Shiva in a day or two.
I think it was a day or two, maybe three, because there were a few days. There were a few days where we really weren't entirely sure. It was interesting. There was it's just a few days there where we really weren't sure what the parameters were of this calamity. And when we really understood it, wasn't immediate. But at that point, it was just widely accepted that we had to make presumptions of death. And, you know, in specific cases, of course, what you had to do is that you had to also say, where was that person on that day? You know, all of us have a story of somebody who had a doctor's appointment, you know, who were the lucky one. And then the others who didn't. So, you know, there was that level of clarification, too. Well, in a few days, all of that happened.
And so then what happens when remains are found later? Do they do it again?
You just bury them.
No, you just bury them. You bury them. And the question could be asked also, and it will come up. We'll talk about this probably a little bit next time. There's also a question of reinterment. Let's say you buried somebody and then you unbury them. Right? This is not unusual. For a variety of different reasons, these things happen. Sometimes people get buried in the wrong cemetery. You know, there was such chaos at the time of the death. People didn't know what was happening, and it ends up that an entire family is one place, and a lone member is someplace totally separate. The family is very upset about that. The family is very upset. Well, we deal with problems like this, and sometimes we have reinterment. Sometimes it's an Israel-related thing.
Herzl's children were just buried.
Yes, Herzl's children were just buried. I told you that story a few weeks ago. The holidays. So, indeed, it's, you know, all those things happen. So there is another question about Shiva, when you take the body out of the ground, whether you, it's a question that's raised, whether you have to have any Shiva at all at that particular point, and how long it would have to last. I want to turn to that now, but we can come back to that at some point.
There's one more point that I was in discussion that doesn't, you know, probably is not valid, but when Shiva begins, there is speculation, religious, I guess, speculation, about the time of the last breath and the spirit leaving the body, or, and is that within the 24 hours of burial?
No, that's different, because that's death. That's the definition of death. How do you decide that a person is dead? That has to do with a variety of markers, of signs.
But the separation of the body from the spirit or whatever.
Oh, once you bury, the separation of the body from the spirit, that is something which, frankly, the detailed first part of that you don't have in the Talmud. You have that in the Kabbalah. And in the Kabbalah, there's a sense of in the Kabbalah, you have the soul hanging around for 7 days. But none of this, you're not going to read about that here. None of this, all much. Okay?
I was trying to create a sort of an existential prerequisite for Shiva. One of it is some sort of final separation, seems to me, from the deceased. Either he's buried or he finally agrees that that person is.
For the beginning of Shiva, you mean? For the beginning of Shiva?
Yeah.
For the beginning of Shiva.
For the beginning.
As opposed to just Shiva.
But you also need, it seems to me, some sort of human interaction between a mourner and somebody else to have a Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's, I mean, somebody could be buried, but if you're in some other place, you have no ability to interact with anybody.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I've read stories like that. It's, somebody, make a good short story, where a person is all alone. The person is Shiva by himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's a poignant, terrible story.
Somebody wrote them?
No, somebody should write them. Mm-hmm. Because it is. It can happen. It can happen. These things happen.
You say that people can sit Shiva after the funeral, even if the body will travel, let's say, to a different place to get buried. But we say that you are Olam until the burial is complete. So those people who sit Shiva are Olam too.
This is an exception to the rule. When you have to go an unusual distance, the rules change because of that exceptional set of circumstances. Last question.
The Holocaust, which is a kind of a 9/11 situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
People disappeared, and nobody knew what happened to them. Sometimes they had no family. Did people sit Shiva if they survived?
That's an interesting story. There are books on that subject, just to see what people did. Sometimes the answer is yes. Most of the time it's no, because there's no opportunity. And the problem or the issue for most people came to be not Shiva, but the art side. The art side. And in every community, we have this in our story too, every community of Jews, of European Jews, has people in the community who observe yard sites on arbitrary days because of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll observe it on the day, let's say, when they know about the community. And the community, the word is that the community was destroyed or sent off to the camps on such a day. And they'll work around that date and decide on a date of the yard site when there's really no knowledge of when the actual death occurred. That too would make a terrible bit of a short story.
Did you see that article in the Times today about the woman whose father perished and survived Auschwitz, and just before he died, he told her the story of what life was like in the camp, which he had not told. And
the woman had died in the camp. The mother.
She didn't die in the camp. She arbitrarily chose that woman's name.
What section is in
there? Finish the third. One here, the third.
The daughter deal with his memory. She had tattooed on her arm the number of the woman that the father was telling her about who was in the room, just to deal with memory. And she had more than that number. You're right, the mother survived and lived in Australia and the daughter.
So these stories are all of them are poignant, and they, you know, they come out of the real life experiences of people, which in some way deal with these same issues. You know, how do you deal with the loss? When do you deal with it? And how do you possibly mourn for it? Okay.
Well, the discussion today has been very poignant because it's the intersection of strict law with incredibly flexible with appreciation of community standards.
And you're going to see that again in this, as this discussion goes on. We will continue to see that. It will reinforce that sense that you have that that's an appropriate way to go about all of this. Okay? Till next week.
You know, it's interesting.